the texts, because the years were named for the king's great achievements. The kings also controlled the military, but even the soldiers were overseen by local generals from Umma. So the evidence from Umma has shown that the kingdom of the third dynasty of Ur was nothing like as centralized as scholars used to think. The provinces paid their taxes to the king, but they had a lot of autonomy. Holding a lot of this economy together, in an interesting way, was a group of merchants. At Umma, there were at least 20 of them during the Ur III period. They worked directly for the governor's administration. Some of what they did is pretty much what you would expect of a merchant. They traveled and acquired valuable goods in distant lands and brought them back to Umma. But they also had other important responsibilities. One is that they seem to have been in charge of collecting and processing fruits, vegetables, and fish for the governor. In the hot climate of southern Mesopotamia, without refrigeration, these foodstuffs would have gone bad very quickly. It seems that merchants were particularly adept at getting perishables from the farm or the river to the consumer as fast as possible. The merchants were also willing to make loans to private individuals. Banking hadn't been invented, but people sometimes needed to borrow grain to sow their crops or to borrow silver to buy something. Merchants had extra grain and silver on hand and could fill this need. One merchant who lived in Ur towards the end of the Ur III period was named Lu Enlila. He was employed by the temple of the moon god and regularly traveled by boat all the way to Magan, which is now Oman, to buy copper. This was a well-established trade route, and he took wool and textiles to pay for the metal. Mesopotamian kingdoms had been getting copper from Oman for a long time, but in the Ur III period, a merchant like Lu Enlila worked directly for the temple, one of those great households. The land of Magan might also have been a diplomatic partner of the kings of Ur. Until the Ur III period, the exchange of envoys and peace treaties, dynastic marriages and diplomatic correspondence seemed to have taken place only among states within Mesopotamia and Syria. But King Shulgi received a gift of gold dust from the king of Magan, according to an administrative text. Luxury gifts were often a sign of diplomacy. Another clue is found in a slightly later text mentioning the arrival of someone named Wedum, who is described as the courier of the governor of Magan. So perhaps the king of Magan sent envoys regularly to Ur with expensive gifts, and perhaps even letters. The Ur kings had close contacts with the lands to the east of Mesopotamia. They directly controlled the city of Susa and had diplomatic ties with other population centers in the same general area of Elam in southwestern Iran. The names of Elamite envoys show up in the administrative texts. They received gifts and attended important festivals. Also, princesses from Ur were sent to marry Elamite kings to cement the alliances. As you can imagine, the city of Ur must have been a pretty cosmopolitan place. Envoys, merchants, and other visitors from distant lands were not an uncommon sight on the streets. In one text, it sounds as though there might even have been South Asians who lived together and worked alongside native Mesopotamians. They're described as men from a Maluha village. Maluha was the Indus Valley. So in addition to hearing Elamite spoken as you walked around Ur, you would probably also hear the languages of Magan and Maluha, along with the local languages of Sumerian and Akkadian. And there probably would have been another language heard on the streets, Amorite. It was spoken by people from lands to the west and north. Throughout the Ur III period, immigrants from this region settled in Mesopotamia. They were referred to as the Martu, or Westerners, or as the Tidnum. And their language was Semitic, similar to Akkadian, but also closely related to later West Semitic languages, like Arabic and Hebrew. So the Ur III kings tried a different approach to running their empire than had been seen before. The extended household economy flourished and was well organized and effective. In addition, the Ur III rulers created something of a cult of the kings. They emphasized their greatness and encouraged people to believe that the kings were on their side. Even in modern times, there's been a tendency to see Shulgi as one of the great kings of Mesopotamian history. But as it turned out, the empire lasted for little more than a century. And the Ur III kings might have achieved less than they would have had us believe, because in the end, they had trouble holding onto their empire.
Lecture 12, Migrants and Old Assyrian Merchants.
Mesopotamia was a place where people spoke many languages. It started with Sumerian, which was dominant in the south, and Akkadian, which was spoken more often in the center and north. The early people of Ebla in Syria spoke a language that we refer to as Eblaite. And there was also a large population of people in northern Syria who spoke a language called Hurrian. Akkadian and Eblaite were Semitic languages, but Sumerian and Hurrian were unrelated to Semitic and unrelated to one another. Then, down from the Zagros Mountains, came the Gutians, who invaded at the end of the Akkadian Empire and spoke yet another language, as did the Elamites, who lived in what is now Iran, to the east. Almost all of these people adopted cuneiform as their writing system. This was a wedge-shaped script, usually written on clay tablets. They mostly expressed themselves in the dominant languages of Sumerian and Akkadian, though they also sometimes wrote texts in their own languages. It seems that the curriculum in scribal schools was similar everywhere and very traditional. So scribes continued to learn Sumerian long after it was no longer spoken much at all. Cuneiform represented sounds and whole words, so it could be used, in theory anyway, to record just about any language. The fact that scribes who spoke other languages tended to write in Akkadian or Sumerian is probably because of their training, in the same way that monks of the medieval period wrote in Latin, even if they didn't speak it much. Also, there were challenges to writing down some languages in cuneiform. For example, some sounds aren't represented because they don't seem to have occurred in Akkadian, like the sounds of the letters O, F, J, and V. I sometimes teach the basics of cuneiform to middle school kids, and I have them try to write their names using the cuneiform script. Boys named Joseph face a challenge, since three of the sounds in their names can't be written. The speakers of some ancient languages probably had similar difficulties when writing in cuneiform, if they had different sounds in their words. Just like when we try to write Chinese or Arabic words using the alphabet that we inherited from the Romans, they must have made compromises. Anyway, the point of this is that Mesopotamia was a big melting pot of people who came from different parts of the Near East and spoke different languages. Mesopotamia was a river valley with few natural boundaries, such as mountain ranges or coastlines, so it was always open to people migrating from other places. It had also always been very open to trade. There must have been tons of official translators and plenty of people who were bilingual as well. Sometimes, when a new group showed up speaking an unknown language, they were viewed with suspicion at first, like the Gutians, who were even described in literary works as not quite human. But they almost always ended up settling down and becoming part of the culture, and often they took leading roles and headed new dynasties. Quite quickly, they stopped being viewed as foreigners and became part of the community. One of these new groups started showing up during the Ur III period in the late 3rd millennium BCE. And by the end of that dynasty, the kings of Ur seem to have been increasingly worried about them. The new arrivals were called the Amorites. A high official wrote to one of the last Ur III kings, named Shu-Sin, that the Amorites have repeatedly raided the territory in the north. He reminded the king of what he had been instructed to do. "You ordered me to rebuild the fortification, to cut off their infiltration route, to prevent them from swooping down on the fields through a breach in the defenses between the Tigris and Euphrates." King Shusin did build a wall to keep the Amorites out, just as the official described. He named a year after this achievement. The wall might have been erected at the point where the Tigris and Euphrates flow closest together. But it doesn't seem to have been successful. Immigrants continued to move into Mesopotamia from different regions. The last king of the dynasty, Ibbi-Sin, commemorated a military victory over the Amorites in one of his year names. He called it the year the Amorites, the powerful south wind, who from remote past have not known cities, submitted to Ibbi-Sin, the king of Ur. So who were the Amorites? A myth described them as being completely uncivilized. The Amorites, who know no grain, no house nor town, the boors of the mountains. The Amorite who digs up truffles, who does not bend his knees to cultivate the land, who eats raw meat, who has no house during his lifetime, who is not buried after his death. As you can tell from this description, the Mesopotamians believed that the Amorites had started out as nomads rather than farmers, traveling seasonally with their sheep and goats. Scholars thought for some time that the conflict in the late Ur III period was a result of these nomadic Amorites wanting to settle in the agricultural lands of Mesopotamia. But this doesn't seem to have any basis in fact. There were some Amorites who were nomads, but there were others who seem to have always lived in cities. The name Amorite just means people from the west. Their language also shows they were Western. Amorite was a West Semitic language, not East Semitic like Akkadian. Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic are also West Semitic languages, though those came later. Weirdly, the Amorites didn't write their language down much. Even though Amorite scribes learned to read and write, they always wrote in Akkadian and Sumerian. The way we know something about the grammar and vocabulary of their language is from their personal names. The names give us a sense of how Amorite was spoken, because everyone's name was a phrase. These were often about the gods, so someone's name might be beloved of the god Dagon, or gift of the goddess Ninkarak. Amorite parents tended to give their children names that made sense in their own language. The Amorites were blamed by some later Mesopotamians for the end of the Ur III kingdom, but the real situation was much more complex. Even before any invasions, there was a famine that severely affected the kingdom. A later poem lamenting the fate of Ur put it this way. Enlil installed a pestilent famine in the city. He installed a city destroyer and a temple destroyer in the city. There was no beer in the brewery. There was no malt. There was no food for him, that's the king, in his palace. No grain filled his magnificent storehouse. He could not bear his life. Inflation seems to have skyrocketed, and people were desperate for food. A high official named Ishbi-Ira took advantage of the weakness of Ibbi-Sin, the last Ur king. This official, Ishbi-Ira, stopped working for the king and set himself up as an independent leader in the southern city of Isin. Someone wrote about this to King Ibbi-Sin, and we actually have this letter. It tells the king that the renegade official, Ishbi-Ira, believed he had been promised the kingship over the land by the god Enlil, and the god had also promised to remove King Ibbi-Sin from power. The letter goes on to say, "It was just as he, Ishbi-Ira, said. He captured Nippur. The land trembles like a reed fence from his clamor. Ishbi-Ira goes everywhere at the head of his troops." You can imagine how unnerving this must have been for King Ibbi-Sin. All the signs suggested the gods were against him. The famine, Ishbi-Ira's success in breaking away and making his own little kingdom out of part of the kingdom of Ur. And then there were the increasing numbers of Amorites settling throughout the kingdom. And then around 2004 BCE, Ur was invaded, but not by the Amorites. Instead, the attack came from Elam to the east. First, the Elamites took over the city of Susa. This was an economic blow to the Ur III kingdom, since Susa and the lands in that eastern region were rich and important for the trade routes that flourished there. But even by then, the Ur three kings had already overextended themselves, and they'd broken important diplomatic ties. A few years later, the Elamites destroyed the capital of Ur and took poor Ibbi-Sin as a hostage back to Elam. For a few years, the Elamites ruled Ur, but they were forced out in the end by Ishbi-Ira, that former official who had set up his own kingdom in Isin and who was so convinced that Enlil had wanted him to reign. So Ishbi-Ira did found his own dynasty in Isin, but he didn't control all of the territory that had been subject to the Ur three kings. Instead, it splintered into a number of smaller kingdoms. In some ways, the beneficiaries of the dissolution of the Ur three kingdom ended up being the Amorites, even though they weren't the ones who had caused it. The 2 centuries that followed the end of the third dynasty of Ur were full of wars. The new kingdoms each had a king who ruled from a major city and who was supported by a number of vassal kings in smaller cities. Their armies fought one another frequently. The various kings made alliances, broke them, and made new alliances, only to break these too. Some of their vassals also switched sides on a regular basis, so some of the warfare was directed at bringing vassal kingdoms back into the fold. There's a well-known letter written around this time that sums up the situation. The letter was written by an official to the king of Mari, which was a kingdom along the Euphrates in eastern Syria. The official said, "There is no king who is strong on his own. Hammurabi of Babylon has a following of 10 or 15 kings. Rimsin of Larsa, the same. Ibal-Piel of Eshnunna, the same. Amut-Piel of Katna, the same. And Yarim-Lim of Yamhad has a following of 20 kings. Add to that the 10 or 15 kings who followed the king of Mari, and that's between 70 and 100 rulers in Mesopotamia during this time. Some of the vassal kings had very small domains, but each had sworn a treaty with his overlord, one of the 6 or 7 major kings, and sent troops to support his overlord in times of war, and paid taxes as well. I'll spare you the details of the many wars that were fought, but during these turbulent times, people seem to have looked back on the third dynasty of Ur as a long-lost period of peace and comfort. Lamentations were written about the destruction of the great cities of Ur, Uruk, Nippur, and Eridu that had happened at the end of the Ur III period. In these lamentations, the destruction wasn't blamed on the Elamite invaders. Instead, the people, as always, blamed the gods and thought that the invaders had simply been carrying out the will of the gods. They even thought that the city god of Ur, the moon god Nanna, was responsible for the destruction. Nanna had abandoned his people, and that was why the Elamites had been successful. A lamentation about the destruction of Ur put it this way. "Rebellion fell upon the land, something which no one had known. It was something which had not been seen, something unspeakable, something that could not be grasped. All the lands were confounded in their fear. The gods of the city turned away. The shepherd fell away. Population breathed in fear." Right after the Ur III dynasty, the people might have thought that their civilization was coming to an end. Things must have been desperate. Maybe they told stories about the greatness of Ornama and Shulgi, and before them, Sargon and Naram-Sin, and before them, the mythical early dynastic king Gilgamesh, who perhaps lived around 2500 BCE. His reign was as far in the past to the people of 2000 BCE as Shakespeare and Elizabeth I are to us today. But we have the benefit of hindsight, and we know this wasn't an end at all. It was the prelude to a time of prosperity and renewed vitality, known as the Old Babylonian period. During the era of widespread warfare that followed the Ur III period, many cities had new kings on the throne, kings who founded new dynasties, and many of these dynasties were of Amorite descent. These Amorite kings were especially common in the center and northwest of Mesopotamia. One Amorite dynasty began to rule the previously unimportant city of Babylon and successfully passed the throne from father to son for centuries. Among the kings of Babylon was the famous Hammurabi, who ruled from about 1792 to 1750 BCE. Other important kingdoms of the era were those mentioned in that letter I quoted a moment ago, Katna and Yamhud in the west, Mari in the northwest, Ekalatum in the northeast, Eshnunna in the east, and Isin and Larsa to the south of Babylon. These eight kingdoms were the squabbling successors to the third dynasty of Ur. Yamhud was the biggest of them. Its capital city was in Aleppo, in the north of Syria near Turkey. Unfortunately, we don't know much about Yamhud because the archives of the royal court have never been discovered. They must be somewhere deep under modern Aleppo. Perhaps they'll never be recovered. Aleppo has been continuously occupied since ancient times, so the old Babylonian remains lie under the debris of all the intervening periods, the Neo-Assyrian Empire, the Persian Empire, Hellenistic Greek Empire of Alexander the Great, the Roman Empire, the early Islamic period, and on, right up to the present day. It's an odd fact, actually, that the sites best known for their archaeological finds weren't necessarily all that important in ancient times. And the cities that were really important sometimes haven't even been found yet, like Agade, the ancient capital of the Akkadian Empire. Or they're hidden under vast amounts of later remains, like Aleppo. The way we tell the history of the Old Babylonian period would probably be very different if we had more details about the kings of Yamhud and their administrations in Aleppo. All we know is the names of the kings and a little bit about their political history. On the other hand, we have a great deal of information about some Mesopotamian people from this era who weren't kings at all. One striking thing about the early second millennium BCE is that a lot more documents have been found in ancient private houses. For eras before the Old Babylonian period, most of the documents were found in public buildings, such as palaces and temples. The tablets from private houses show us that people were able to run their own businesses and own their own houses and fields, much more than had been true in earlier periods. It seems also that a lot more people were able to read, and maybe to write as well. It would still have been a very small percentage of the population, but these literate people didn't all work for the big institutions anymore, like the palace and the temple. One group of people who could read and write, and who were entrepreneurial, and who got rich, were merchants. And one group of Mesopotamian merchants has left us an amazing record of their lives and their businesses. Weirdly enough, their records weren't found in Mesopotamia. They were found in Turkey. In the early 20th century, a number of cuneiform tablets began appearing on the worldwide antiquities market. They included letters that had clearly been written by merchants, and they were said to have been found in Turkey, at the site of an ancient city called Kanesh. Turkish archaeologists went to dig there, beginning in 1948, but their excavations uncovered no cuneiform tablets at all. Finally, a villager gave away the secret. The tablets that other villagers had found and sold hadn't come from the mound at all, but from a particular place in the fields nearby. The excavators turned their attention there. This area turned out to be a sort of suburb of the main city, a neighborhood of private houses. Its inhabitants called it the Karam. Karam usually meant harbor in Akkadian, but there was no river or waterway of any sort there. Harbors were centers for trade, and that was the meaning of Karam in this case. It was the place where merchants gathered and found customers. The surprising thing about these merchants of Kanesh is that they weren't local to the area. They were from the city of Ashur, which is more than 800 miles away to the east on the Tigris River in northern Mesopotamia. So what were they doing there? Their tablets reflect the earliest known use of the cuneiform script in Anatolia, which is modern-day Turkey. But the Anatolians hadn't adopted it yet. The Assyrian merchants brought with them their habit of keeping records on clay tablets, right along with the goods they carried to trade. Many houses in the Karam belonged to these Assyrian traders, and they kept their records stored in the houses, sometimes hundreds of documents in a single residence. For example, one house excavated in 1993 contained 178 letters, 69 loan contracts, 38 records of legal proceedings, and 102 personal accounts. In total, 17,700 tablets have come out of the excavations, and almost 5,000 more came from the site before the excavation started. These tablets give us a vivid picture of what life was like for an Assyrian merchant in the 20th and 19th centuries BCE. Unlike merchants of earlier times, these men weren't representing a temple or a king or any other major institution. The government of Ashur hadn't sent them, and the king seemed to have almost no control over them. Instead, the traders were organized as families, and these merchant families acted pretty much on their own. The merchants even drew up a treaty with the king of Kanesh, a treaty that protected both parties and facilitated trade between them. This is a remarkable document. Most treaties were between two kings, but in this case, the Assyrian merchants represented themselves. The king of Ashur wasn't involved. The merchants were insured against theft. The king of Kanesh pledged to replace stolen goods if a thief couldn't be found, but only if the merchant was willing to swear an oath that he'd been robbed. The king of Kanesh had to swear that he wouldn't try to take their goods or to force them to sell the goods cheaply to him. On the other hand, the merchants pledged to pay taxes to him, one-tenth of what they were selling. It seems to have been a good arrangement, and they all benefited. The Assyrians lived among the Anatolians with the blessing and support of the local king, and no violence seems to have been involved in the Assyrians' occupation in Kanesh. The Assyrians didn't have to invade. They had goods for sale that the Anatolians really wanted, so they were welcome. The most desirable items they sold were tin and textiles. In exchange, the Anatolians had a ready supply of silver, which the Assyrians needed, because it had become the medium of exchange throughout Mesopotamia, and because there were no known mineral resources or metal ores in Mesopotamia at the time. So this was how it worked. An Assyrian merchant family gathered together a shipment of textiles and tin in the city of Ashur. The textiles were not just everyday plain fabrics. They had to be particularly finely made, often by Babylonian women from south of Assyria, whose weaving was thought to be especially good. Plenty of letters exist documenting the efforts of merchants to find the very best textiles to take with them. The Assyrians paid the weavers for these textiles, though they paid much less, of course, than the goods were sold for. Some of them were made in the region of Ashur, but these weren't valued as much as the ones from areas of Mesopotamia further to the south. Of course, almost everyone in the Near East had access to wool, but not everyone had the same level of skill in spinning, dyeing, and weaving. The Mesopotamian weavers did something extraordinary, maybe with colored designs or embroidery or the fineness of the weave. Whatever their particular specialty was, it made their textiles incredibly sought after. Unfortunately, none of the textiles have survived, so we can't examine them to see what was so remarkable about them. But if you think about the value and quality of Persian carpets or Chinese silks or Navajo rugs in later times, you can get a sense of why the Anatolians wanted to buy them. The Assyrian merchants also bought tin from the mountain areas to the east and shipped it on to Anatolia. Tin was an essential component of bronze, so it was always needed. Again, the merchants were able to mark up the price and make a big profit by selling the tin in Anatolia. Fabric was transported in big rolls, and the tin was formed into ingots. Both were loaded up onto the backs of black donkeys for the long overland journey. Sometimes the merchant who was preparing to make the trip to Anatolia had borrowed money from a relative in order to buy the textiles and the tin, along with the donkeys he needed for his trading mission. That relative expected to be paid back and didn't expect to have to ask for the payment. There are a number of letters that survive, in which the family member was put into the awkward position of calling out his brother or cousin for not paying his debts. This was considered to be rather rude, but sometimes it was necessary. So the donkeys were loaded with their goods, and it was time to go. A caravan set off for Anatolia, taking 2 or 3 months to reach its destination, more than 800 miles away. This wasn't an easy journey. The merchants would pass along the northern reaches of the Mesopotamian river valleys and then up through a pass in the Taurus Mountains and onto the Anatolian plateau. Sometimes they would be robbed along the way. Sometimes they seemed to have tried to avoid paying taxes at checkpoints. Smuggling could land the men in prison, but they don't seem to have remained incarcerated for long, and in any event, they kept writing letters from prison, continuing to manage their businesses. When the merchants reached the city of Kanesh in Anatolia, they went first to the palace of the king so that he could pick out the textiles that he would take as his tax. Then they were free to join their family members in the Karum, the trading quarter, and to begin to sell the rest of the shipment. Representatives of all the major trading families seemed to have lived year-round in the houses in the Karum at Kanesh. Presumably, the visiting traders stayed in their relatives' houses. We can guess that this is true because letters found in the houses were often addressed to several different adult members of a family. Letters from home took almost as long to reach Anatolia as the caravans took to get there, so it wasn't possible to communicate quickly. One fascinating thing about the houses of the Anatolian merchants is that the design is exactly the same as what you see in the houses of the local Anatolian people at this time. Even the pottery found in the houses is the same. The archaeologists who excavated the site said that if it weren't for the cuneiform tablets, they wouldn't have had any idea that this neighborhood was home to a colony of expatriate Assyrians. So the Assyrians hadn't come to impose their culture. They were just long-term visitors. But some of them did marry Anatolian wives. Most Assyrian men had just one wife. But a trader living away from home was allowed to have two wives, one in each city, so long as the families were kept separate. The women of the merchant families were often very involved in trade. They didn't just do some of the weaving, they also helped run the business when their husbands were away. Not all the merchants stayed in Kanesh once they had arrived. Some of them went on to other towns and cities in Anatolia, selling their textiles and tin wherever they went. The silver that they were paid weighed very little, even though it was so valuable. They didn't need donkeys to ship the silver back home, so they sold the donkeys as well. The return journey to Ashur must have been faster and easier than the journey to get there. The silver acquired in Anatolia was then put to use in paying for business expenses and in buying a whole new shipment of goods to send back. And so this trading cycle continued over and over for more than 100 years.
Lecture 13, Royalty and Palace Intrigue at Mari.
A powerful king named Shamshi-Adad was able to build a short-lived empire in northern Mesopotamia and Syria during the 18th century BCE, after the Near East had been in turmoil for some time. 7 or 8 major kingdoms had been fighting one another, battling over borders, maneuvering to gain alliances, and stealing one another's vassals. Early in his reign, his land of Akhalatum had been conquered by a neighboring kingdom, forcing Shamshi-Adad to flee to exile in Babylon. But he was able to recapture Akhalatum not long after, and then he kept going, taking over the city of Ashur, which was home to the Assyrian merchants who traded in Anatolia, and then going on to the Habur River and managing to conquer the kingdom of Mari on the Euphrates in Syria. At this point, Shamshi-Adad's empire extended from the Euphrates to the Tigris rivers, just to the south of what is now Turkey. This included some rich agricultural land. The northern region of the empire gets enough rainfall for dry farming, farming without irrigation. But the rivers were available to provide irrigation water when needed. Shamshi Adad had a rather grandiose sense of his own importance. Instead of giving a name to his empire, he took the title King of the Universe. In doing so, he was following in the footsteps of Sargon and the other great Akkadian kings who came before him, even though his empire was considerably smaller. We know quite a lot about him because we have some of his personal letters, most of them written to his two sons, as well as his royal inscriptions. Shamshi Adad's older son was named Ishme Dagan, and the younger one was Yahma Adu. They were already adults when Shamshi Adad had completed his empire, and their father decided to bring them into his administration to help him rule. He would be the great king, but his sons would be kings as well. Each son was set up in a palace in a major city. Ishme Dagan's palace was in Ekalatum, the dynasty's original capital. This was in the Tigris region. Yasma Adu's palace was in Mari. Shamshi Adad created a new capital city for himself between the other two cities and to the north of them. He called it Shubat Enlil. All three kings, in turn, had vassal kings who answered to them. This was a new approach to ruling an empire, but it wasn't entirely successful. Yasma Adu was in a position to help his father with an important ally, the king of Katna, a kingdom to the west, near the Mediterranean. Yasma Adu would marry the king of Katna's daughter. Diplomatic marriages had a long history by this time. It had been more than 600 years since the kings of Ebla had arranged marriages of their daughters to allies and vassals, and similar marriages had taken place ever since. In Yasma Adu's case, we can see the actual stages of the marriage. There's a whole sequence of letters found in his palace at Mari about his marriage to Princess Beltum of Katna. It seems Yasma Adu didn't have a lot of say in the matter. It was all arranged by his father, Shamshi Adad, and by Beltum's father, the king of Katna. The preliminaries went something like this. Shamshi Adad wrote to Yasma Adu to tell him about the negotiations that had been completed with the princess's father. The princess was going to be given the title of Queen of Mari. This made her the chief wife, who would be present for major ceremonies with the king. King Yasma Adu also had at least one wife already, so the new bride would be coming in at a higher rank than the current one. Both sides provided vast quantities of silver. Shamshi Adad paid 4 talents of silver to the king of Katna for what was called the terhatum, a bridal gift. A talent weighed about 60 pounds, so that's 240 pounds, with a present-day market value of about $64,000. But let's compare that to what the bride brought to the marriage and add in some other factors. The king of Katna gave a dowry to his daughter of 10 talents of silver and garments worth 5 talents of silver. So this princess brought 600 pounds of silver with her as her dowry, with a present-day value of $160,000. This was an enormous amount of wealth, and, like all dowries, it was hers to keep and to pass on to her children. But a manual laborer could hope to earn just 1 shekel of silver per month, a 60th of a pound. So Beltum's dowry was the equivalent of 3,000 years of pay for a laborer. In modern times, suppose someone earning minimum wage makes about $1,700 a month. Calculated this way, Beltum's dowry in silver alone would have been worth about $61 million. Next, the princess's father wrote to his new son-in-law, Yasma Adu. It was a friendly letter, telling him that, with this marriage, the two royal houses had become one. He said, and I quote, "I am placing in your lap my flesh and future, for this house has become yours, and the house of Mari has now become mine." He also hoped that Yasma Adu would find Princess Beltum attractive. Apparently, the groom hadn't met his bride yet. And Beltum's father promised that he'd send anything that Yasma Adu requested. But there was a little bit of a complaint in the letter. Of the groom's father, Shamshi Adad, he wrote, Why is it that whatever I desire from the king, he does not give it? Apparently, Shamshi-Adad wasn't very reliable about reciprocating when it came to gifts. He hoped his new son-in-law would be a better diplomatic partner. But soon after Beltim arrived in Mari, things started going badly for her. Apparently, her husband Yasma'adu set her up in a house away from the citadel, not in the palace at all. Now, Shamshi-Adad, the groom's father, immediately wrote to intervene, reminding his son that this looked very bad, especially given the high status of the queen. Her father might be really angry about this, seeing it as an insult, and he was an important ally. Shamshi-Adad continued, "This is simply not done. There are many chambers in the Palm Palace. A chamber should be prepared for her and house her there. Do not house her externally." So she did end up being moved into the palace, it seems. But once there, a new crisis developed. Palace officials couldn't stand Beltum's nanny. This was a woman who had taken care of the new bride since childhood and still waited on her. When Yasma'adu was away from the palace at one point, an official wrote him, calling the nanny unreliable. She apparently didn't understand the practices of the Mari palace. For instance, the official wrote, "During the siesta, when the palace's bolt was set, she had her bring out songstresses to the Temple of Ishtar in the midst of a ceremony." This was apparently a major faux pas. Worse, Princess Beltum went out in the sun and suffered sunstroke as a result. Officials sent several more letters to her husband, reassuring him that she'd recover. So perhaps he'd developed some affection for her after all. 2 years into the marriage, Beltum's father wrote to Yasma'adu asking him to bring the princess with him when Yasma'adu visited Katna with his troops. "Bring my daughter along with you so that she could conciliate with the gods of her city and so that I could give her many gifts. She should meet with me so that I could honor her." Presumably the visit happened, and the king of Katna got the chance to hear directly from his daughter about court life at Mari. No doubt she told him about the initial humiliation of being housed outside the palace, and about her illness, and about the treatment of her nanny. But she probably also gave him valuable information about the politics of Mari. We know this from other letters from princesses who married foreign kings. They weren't just wives and mothers. They also sometimes acted as spies for their fathers. In any event, to go back to the relationship between the great king and his sons, one problem with the co-regency was that Beltum's father-in-law, Shamshi-Adad, tended to micromanage his son's administrations. We can guess that this was true for the elder son, Ishme-Dagan, in Ekalatum, but we don't have those letters. The letters to Yasma'adu show that Shamshi-Adad sent messengers to Mari all the time, and that he could be very demanding. He wanted to know why an official hadn't been replaced, or to complain about the servants who had fled the palace, things like that. In fact, all kinds of things upset Shamshi-Adad about his younger son's rule. Mostly, he worried that Yasma'adu was immature, and that the young king started projects without giving them enough thought. One time, Yasma'adu decided to commission statues of 6 gods. Each one needed to be manufactured of gold and silver. But that was just the start of the project's ancillary expenses. His father wrote to him to complain. "These gods that you plan to make require 1 month of festival sacrifices. What? Where are the oxen and sheep that you must keep providing for sacrifice at festivals? Here you keep writing to me, saying, 'I have no sheep or lambs,' yet you would still fill the town with gods here, when however many sheep now available hardly suffice for a sacrifice to them." He finished the letter by stating, "With no flour and sheep whatsoever, without my permission, you would commission the making of gods of gold. You alone must bear the burden of this project." Shamshi-Adad also accused Yasma'adu of spending too much time drinking and dancing with servants. It's clear he didn't trust the younger son all that much. He even made sure that particular officials were present when the letters he sent were read aloud to his son. But there's no sign that Yasma'adu was disloyal to his father. He visited the king often and asked him for advice. Perhaps he did this too much. Shamshi-Adad wished that he would be more independent and decisive. He wrote, How long shall we govern you? Are you truly a child? Are you not an adult? Is there no beard on your chin? How long will you neglect the administration of your house? Ishmi-Dagan, on the other hand, was much more of a chip off the old block. Like his father, the older son was often on campaign. Shamshi-Adad sometimes shamed Gasma-Adu by pointing out that he should be more like his older brother. On one occasion he wrote, "Your brother won a victory, but there you lie among women. Now, when you march with the army to Katna, behave as a man." The brothers wrote to one another as well, and Ishmi-Dagan advised Yasma-Adu to consult with him before writing to their father. That's understandable. Perhaps Ishmi-Dagan was able to arbitrate between them a little. Throughout pretty much all of Shamshi-Adad's reign, the great king's armies were out campaigning against neighboring kingdoms and fighting to maintain control of the region he'd already claimed. It wasn't a stable empire, and it wouldn't survive long after Shamshi-Adad died in 1776 BCE. Ishmi-Dagan became the great king in his father's place, but he had to immediately organize campaigns against Aleppo in the west and Eshnunna in the east. Although we don't know what happened to Yasma-Adu, we do know that soon after Shamshi-Adad died, the local dynasty took control of Mari again. The new king, Zimri Lim, took up residence in the palace, though some of Yasma-Adu's letters were left in the archives. Archaeologists found them there, still in Zimri Lim's archive room, when they excavated the Mari palace centuries later. As it happened, Ishmi-Dagan proved to be less brilliant than he'd seemed to his father. He made some clumsy mistakes, including a ham-fisted attempt at diplomacy with the king of Katna. He asked his younger brother's father-in-law for 2 horses. It was quite normal to ask for gifts. As a king, it was a way of getting luxury goods that you needed. Then you sent something of equal value in exchange. This wasn't trade exactly, because no receipts or contracts were involved, but it wasn't exactly voluntary gift-giving either. Anyway, the king of Katna sent the 2 horses. In return, Ishmi-Dagan sent 20 pounds of tin, apparently thinking this was a fair exchange. But the king of Katna was furious. The horses were worth vastly more than the tin. So he wrote a devastating letter telling Ishmi-Dagan that, "When you sent me this paltry amount of tin, you had no desire to have honorable discourse with me." The king of Katna went on and on about the rudeness of Ishmi-Dagan and ended by saying, "Why have you done this? This house is your house." He meant they were connected by marriage and alliance. Ishmi-Dagan's obligation was to send what the king of Katna had requested, and certainly to send a gift of equivalent value. Ishmi-Dagan's career didn't improve. His kingdom shrank, and he ended up being demoted to a son of the other great kings of the time, rather than continuing as a brother. Hammurabi, the king of Babylon, wrote to Ishmi-Dagan, "To those kings that write me as sons, you write as brother." The kings who wrote to Hammurabi as his sons were his vassals. According to Hammurabi, Ishmi-Dagan was now a brother of those kings, meaning that he was an equal of the vassals and no longer as powerful as the king of Babylon. The ultimate humiliation was that Zimri Lim, the king who took over control of Mari, which had been one of Ishmi-Dagan's provinces, was now higher up in the pecking order than Ishmi-Dagan himself. According to Hammurabi's same instructions, "To Zimri Lim, who writes me as a brother, you write as son." Ishmi-Dagan had to refer to himself as the son or inferior of Zimri Lim. He was incensed by this. He had begun his reign as the master of an empire that included Mari. Now he wrote angrily to Hammurabi, stating, "You made me write Zimri Lim as son. Is that man not my servant? He's not sitting on a throne of his own majesty." The appeal was in vain. Ishmi-Dagan was a minor king now. Perhaps his political instincts remained bad, even after that tongue-lashing the king of Katna had given him. Now let's go back to Mari, where Zimri Lim took the throne in 1775 BCE and established a new administration. The palace at Mari has been excavated. It's one of the most important excavations in Syria, and one of the most important finds for this whole era. In its time, it was famous for being a particularly spectacular royal residence. Even better, for us at least, the palace had been conquered and burned, and pretty much abandoned after that. So the mud bricks in the walls were baked hard from the fire, and the walls still stood as much as 13 feet tall when the archaeologists found them. I visited the site of Mari some years ago. I found it a very moving experience to stand in the courtyards and rooms of the palace. The French archaeologists who excavated there had installed a roof to protect the ancient walls. At most archaeological sites, you really have to use your imagination to recreate a sense of the ancient place because just foundations are left. But at Mari, I was standing right there in the palace, inside the very walls where Zimri Lim had met with his advisors or welcomed visiting dignitaries. We can get an amazing glimpse of what royal life was like during the Old Babylonian period, not just from the Mari Palace, but also from the objects and cuneiform tablets found in it. The palace was vast. It had more than 260 rooms, divided up into sectors. There were workshops, storerooms, private apartments, kitchens, public spaces, offices, archives, a throne room, bathrooms, and even a temple. It would have taken some time to find your way around. The plan was something of a maze, and there were no signs to tell you where to go. No doubt guards were posted to make sure that visitors didn't wander into private rooms. At the heart of the palace was a courtyard, planted with palm trees, and beyond it, the throne room, where King Zimri Lim received visitors and messengers. The walls were painted brightly with murals. One showed a procession of sacrificial animals accompanied by high officials. Another showed an investiture scene in which the king stood in front of the goddess Ishtar to receive the symbols of his authority, a rod and a ring. This scene was surrounded with images of palm trees, birds, fantastic winged animals, and goddesses, all painted in bright colors. The paintings might look a little gaudy for modern taste, but the Mesopotamians loved color. Outside the throne room, just in from the courtyard, stood a beautifully carved stone statue of a goddess holding a water jar. The pipe inside the statue turned it into a fountain so that water could pour out of the jar. Zimri Lim's throne room was vast, 82 feet long and 40 feet wide. At one end was a throne for the king, and at the other, a platform containing statues of Zimri Lim's ancestors. Presumably, the room was decorated with rugs and wall hangings, and there would have been a line of clerestory windows along the top of the wall to bring in light. Everything in the palace confirmed the impression that Zimri Lim was enormously wealthy and powerful. Even the food served to him was elaborate. In the kitchens, archaeologists found molds for shaping bread into edible works of art. Like old-fashioned jello molds, they allowed the bread to take the shapes of fish or deer or goddesses. King Zimri Lim had bathrooms with clay bathtubs and indoor plumbing for the toilets. But the bathtubs had no drains, and they must have been filled and emptied by hand. In palace workshops, some skilled artisans made gold jewelry. Every fragment of gold was carefully weighed and recorded on clay tablets. Women were hired to spin wool and weave and embroider cloth. Again, the scribes kept track of every ounce of dye and wool that was handed out, who received it, which women were working in teams together, what textiles they produced, and what the quality was. The records of all these workshops were carefully archived. The whole palace must have hummed with activity. In the middle of all this, of course, lived King Zimri Lim and his family. He ruled there for only 13 years, from 1775 to 1762 BCE. But the 22,000 cuneiform tablets found in his archives make it one of the best-known eras in all of Mesopotamian history. The king was constantly in touch with his officials, governors, and family members. Letters were dictated by the king, written down by scribes, and carried across the kingdom by messengers. Letters that arrived in reply were read aloud to him and then archived. Unfortunately for us, the letters weren't dated, so it can be challenging to reconstruct the order of the events they describe. But the overall impression they give us is that Zimri Lim was a careful diplomat, a strong commander, a meticulous administrator, and a caring husband and father. Unlike Yasma Adu, the previous ruler of the Mari region, King Zimri Lim was away on campaign a lot. The wars of Shamshi Adad's time hadn't come to an end. When Zimri Lim was gone, his wife, Queen Shibtu, was in charge of the palace affairs, and she wrote frequently to her husband to let him know anything of importance that took place. Often, she wrote about important messages from the gods. Any prophecy had to be taken into consideration when planning military moves. These messages sometimes came in the form of dreams or visions that people had while in temples. Sometimes the prophets were given a potion to drink that induced visions. In one letter, Shibtu describes a reassuring vision of soldiers who proclaimed the king's legitimacy. She wrote, "Soldiers on the right are shouting to those on the left, 'Given to Zimri Lim our kingship, scepter, throne, dynasty and land, both upper and lower.'" Another vision, also relayed by Queen Shibtu to the king, told him that a rebellion was expected. Sometimes the visions were incredibly specific. Here's one. "There will not be a battle. As it nears, his allies will be scattered. Ishme Dagon's head will be cut and placed at my lord's feet." This was the same Ishme Dagon of Akalatum that we've been talking about. But the men and women who told Shibtu about these visions were wrong. Ishme Dagon didn't die with his head at her husband's feet. Instead, he died much later in his own bed. Other letters were about the day-to-day running of the palace. Shibtu instructed officials on things that needed to be done and described how she used her cylinder seal to secure storerooms when necessary. She would have rolled the seal on a lump of clay attached to the door. This was a way of locking the room, since the seal had to be broken if anyone entered. Zimri Lim wrote to the queen as well, asking her in some letters to take care of various administrative needs, and in others to consult prophets or oracles, or to meet him at a different city in the kingdom. It's clear that the queen was not just his wife, but also a highly trusted advisor and surrogate. Zimri Lim was surrounded by women during his lifetime. He had several wives and at least 11 daughters. No sons are mentioned in the letters. You won't be surprised to hear that many of the daughters were married off to Zimri Lim's allies and vassals, along with high officials like governors and controllers. He counted on his daughters to be loyal to him and to keep him up to date with news. The messages brought to the court from the Mari princesses are almost Shakespearean in their convoluted politics. One daughter wrote, "If in truth my lord," that's Zimri Lim, "loves the city Shuna," her husband's capital, "and his servant Ili Ishtar, do hurry here 100 soldiers and your trustworthy officer, and do save your city and servant, else the enemy will seize the city." A couple of the king's daughters were thoroughly unhappy in their marriages and not at all afraid to tell their father about it. They dictated frank letters to their messengers to be carried to the king. Princess Inib Shari, for example, was first married off to a tribal leader, who soon died. Then she was married to another of her father's vassals. Her letters are full of the misery of her life, because her second husband neglected her and preferred another wife. "My eyes are full of tears and my mouth hungers," she wrote. Adding about her spouse, "He has reinforced the guard over me." In a later letter, she says, "I am lacking food and firewood, so that events are much worse than before." Over and over again, Zimri Lim's forlorn daughter tells him to rescue her. "My lord should send his servants to fetch me to my lord so that I can see my lord's face." Another of Zimri Lim's daughters, Kiram, was married to a violent and reckless king who threatened to kill her. This husband was also married to another of Zimri Lim's daughters, whom he much preferred. As Kiram's situation worsened, even her servants were taken away. In one letter to her father, she quoted her husband as saying, "Since I plan to have you killed, he," Zimri Lim, "should come and take you back." Kiram wrote, "If my lord does not fetch me back to Mari, I shall grasp my nose and jump from the roof." It's unclear whether Zimri Lim ever did manage to rescue her. He certainly tried at least once, but a letter about it says her husband refused to release her. We can only hope that both of the unhappy princesses, Inibshari and Kiram, eventually obtained divorces and returned to